Good morning and happy holidays. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be keeping you company today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This morning, we welcome back Wisconsin Public Radio's own Steve Paulson. He's executive producer of the nationally syndicated show To the Best of Our Knowledge, and he's author of the new book, Adams and Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science. Well, we had Steve on during our fall membership drive, and there was such a huge response. The lines were lit up, and we didn't have the full hour to be with him, so we wanted to ask him back and get a chance to go deeper into the topic and give you a chance to ask Steve your questions as well. So this hour, we'll be talking about his fascinating new collection of interviews done with some of the big thinkers at the front lines of science and religion, people like Stuart Kaufman, Richard Dawkins, and Walter Isaacson, and also the move to incorporate the language of awe and wonder for science. And Steve is going to give us a short awe and wonder reading list for the scientist or naturalist on your list. And we're looking forward to hearing from you this morning. Can science and religion coexist? What do you consider the big questions in the debate? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Steve Paulson, thank you so much for being our guest again today.
Oh, Veronica, it's my pleasure.
Well, we tend to think of religion as sort of the go-to stop for feelings of awe and wonder, transcendence. But lately, you say there's been a move of scientists to kind of grab some of that language back. What's going on there?
Oh, to me, this is one of the most fascinating movements going on right now. There are a number of secular scientists and philosophers who, if you ask them, do you believe in God, they would say no. But a lot of them are uncomfortable about being kind of lumped into the atheist camp because they think that sort of there are certain things that go along with that. There's often a kind of a hostility to religion, obviously depends on which atheist you're talking about. And so a number of these people are trying to come up with a science-based spirituality, a science-based sense of the sacred. And it really cuts across disciplines. So there are a number of biologists who are sort of exploring these ideas. There are neuroscientists. There are cosmologists. And so they're drawing on different ideas depending on what they're looking at. And there are philosophers and professors of religious studies. And so it's a pretty fascinating movement, I think. And, you know, because if you think about, you know, what are some of the underlying questions? What's the deepest question that religion often deals with? It's how do we find meaning in the world? How do we find purpose? And the traditional religious response is, well, there is some sort of built-in purpose to the universe, God, or depending on what religion you have, you know, there are different nuances to that. The atheist response is typically, no, there is no sort of cosmic purpose. It's up for us to figure it out, to create that purpose. And then there's this other group, what I kind of jokingly call the awe and wonder crowd, who are saying, you know, if we look to the miracle of nature, the wonder, the sort of the majesty of how this universe was put together, how Earth was put together, we can find meaning in that process. And that's what these people tend to be after.
Well, that's what's interesting, that it's this cross-disciplinary group. You would think the biologists would be at the leading edge of that, mm-hmm. able to find wonder in the biology they see around them. But you're saying it extends to cosmologists and beyond. Can you give me some examples of what these people are pointing to when they talk about the wonder that they feel?
Sure. Well, one of the most prominent figures is E.O. Wilson, the renowned Harvard biologist, one of the most noted, famous living biologists. And he wears different hats, and he's also a great champion of biodiversity. And he has written very movingly about his own experiences of being out in nature. He's a bug guy. I mean, his big thing is ants. He's perhaps the world's authority on ants. And he wrote a wonderful memoir, probably 10 years ago, maybe even longer, called Naturalist, which is all about being out in the woods, being out collecting bugs and snakes, and how incredible that is, and how if you sort of step back and think about, you know, what it took for these animals to evolve, you know, the millions or the billions of years that it took for these creatures to evolve, all the sort of the things that happened to that needed to happen for this to for these creatures to be with us today. It's he would consider that an experience of awe, to recognize the science of that. And so it's very much a science-based understanding of awe. And so that's kind of where he comes from. And then there are sort of different variations of that.
Well, and another person who I know is dear to your reader's heart is David Abram, who has a book out. Remind me what the title mm-hmm. is.
It's called Becoming Animal.
Becoming Animal, right. And he has been on, to the best of our knowledge. He is a master storyteller and a really interesting guy as well, a scientist. But tell us about him and how you stumbled onto him.
Sure. Well, he wrote a kind of a classic book called The Spell of the Sensuous that came out about 10 years ago or so. And this is sort of a follow-up book. He's a philosopher and he's a kind of a cultural ecologist and a really interesting guy. He in his early 20s, he traveled all around as a magician, a sleight of hand magician, a conjurer, and that's how he made his living. You know, sort of kind of an itinerant magician. You know, holding out his hat, doing tricks, and he ended up doing a lot of traveling around Southeast Asia and then going into Nepal. And what he really wanted to do is he wanted to meet the local shamans. And he actually doesn't like the word shaman because he says sort of the word will change depending on what culture you're in. He prefers the phrase traditional magician. And so, it's sort of fascinating when you think about it. So he's a magician himself. Huh. But he does tricks. But he says, you know, really the essence of what magic is all about, it's not about tricks. It's about shifting your perception. And he says that's what the shaman does traditionally is, he does things, or she, to make you see the world in a new way. And that's kind of what Abram is trying to do himself. And so with this book, Becoming Animal, An Earthly Cosmology is the subtitle. It's all about trying to show us how to experience the world through our senses. And so part of his message is that we're so caught up in our head, in our, you know, sort of thinking, you know, just it's a very cognitive process. And he says, you know, just sometimes go outside in bare feet and just feel the grass in your feet, or feel the wind hit you. And, you know, and he would say, the thing that's really fascinating about David Abram is he's an animist. And I confess that I've always sort of been interested in this idea of animism, you know, sort of the idea that there's a living presence in all things. And he would say, not necessarily just in animals or people, he would even extend that to rocks. And so you sort of think, oh, okay, this guy's a little wacko. But no, he's not invoking anything supernatural. There's no nature spirits here, no elves, nothing like that. But what he's saying is, if you know how to sort of respond to these, you know, sort of the rock has a presence, has a physical presence in itself. Or, you know, sometimes, you know, we sometimes think about our houses, the houses that we live in, almost having a personality in itself. What's that all about? And so he's just saying, take that a little more seriously. You know, sort of try to feel some of these things through your body in a way, through your senses, through your sense of smell, through your vision, through your touch. And he says the world will come alive. And his larger point is that is how most of our ancestors, through most of their history, that's how they experienced the world in traditional cultures. And he would say that he has a sort of fascinating take on how this is linked to oral cultures in particular. And then he would say that once written language came in, that kind of changed the way that that we perceive the world. And you know, when you think about it, writing has its own kind of magic. You know, it's like writing is those words come alive. You know, we can go into, hearing those, the language, as, you know, those characters can pop right up. And when you think about it, I mean, that is magical in its own way. And so he's saying, but, you know, go back to the oral cultures, and there was sort of a different kind of response to nature that was sort of this pre-written civilization.
He sounds fascinating. And I know that you have interviewed him twice, I guess, for two different interviews. And there's one that we're going to play a clip from. And this is an amazing story I read last night. I'm looking forward to hearing this clip, is about his experience sort of projecting himself into the body of a raven.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little more about that before we listen?
Sure. Well, let me set this up. So on his travels, this was some years back, he went into Nepal, into the mountains of Nepal, and he'd heard about this powerful traditional magician named Sonam. And so he sort of set out, and he had a guide, a translator, to take him there, and it took him weeks to get there. And he wanted to learn from this person who he was this very powerful sorcerer. And so finally, he and his translator got there. His translator was so spooked by the whole thing. He sort of felt this powerful presence that he just begged to leave. I mean, he sort of felt like there was something almost demonic about this guy. And then so Abram finally meets this guy, you know, in some remote hut. And Sonam, the sorcerer, is like down on his haunches, and he feels like an animal. I mean, that's the way Abram described it. He felt like there was this whole, his body reacted to this person in sort of this strange way. And eventually he kind of becomes friends with Sonam, and Sonam takes him under his wing, and he tries to teach him how to think like a raven and to experience the world like a raven. And what he does is he assigns David Abram to stare into the, sort of the back of the neck of the raven for hours at a time, and just to sort of, you know, it's all an exercise and sort of like sort of being pulled into a raven. And then finally, sort of the ultimate experience is he ends up flying like a raven.
Let's listen.
We were hiking back along a very narrow trail that wound along the side of a very precipitous mountain slope. And at one point in the trail, he rounded a bend up in front, and I couldn't see him for a stretch. As I approached that same bend, I heard the croak of a raven. And then as I came around the bend, I saw this raven perched on a large boulder jutting out to the left of the trail above the river gorge beneath. And this raven was squawking a couple times as it looked at me and blinked and squawked again. And then the raven leapt or hopped off the rock down onto the trail. And as it did so, it seemed first to be flying straight into my face, and my hands flew up as if to protect me. But then it landed on the trail, except the sound was too loud for it to be just the raven landing on the trail. And as I blinked, this small raven turned out to be a person. It was Sonam himself, but he was standing much farther down the trail than I had thought the raven. I thought the raven was really a few feet from me, but it was more 25 feet down the trail. Was Sonam now standing in the trail, looking much smaller than he would have if he was just, 8 or 10 feet away? But I was stunned, and he took off down in front of me again, and I thought, I must have just imagined this. But then he turned, and he cocked his head, looking at me, and he squawked, a perfect series of raven's caws. And I realized that I had just witnessed a transformation of a human into a bird, and back again.
You write about how he then gave you various exercises to do to essentially experience the world like a raven. I mean, very rigorous exercises to almost call up a raven to come and visit you and then stare at a certain part of a raven. And then eventually you seem to fly like a raven.
I was watching a raven very, very intently and placing my focus not just on the back of its neck, but sinking the focus of my eyes into its body and trying to bring my other senses, my tactile and visceral senses, to bear over there where my eyes were focused in the body of this other bird, so that when the bird hopped and then spread its wings and took off, I quite unexpectedly found myself aloft and soaring over the river gorge with this bird. Again, it was completely unexpected, but it was an experience that dramatically changed my life and my sense of what the human body is capable of and what our senses and human perception is capable of.
A clip of David Abram, an animist philosopher, talking about his experience, I guess, inhabiting the body of a raven. I mean, I guess if that's not on Wonder, what is?
Right, right. And if I can put in a plug for To the Best of Our Knowledge, this will actually be a part of a program that's on To the Best of Our Knowledge this weekend. In fact, the show is called Can Science Be Sacred? And we'll come at this perspective from many different angles. This is a part of a larger 5-hour series called Science and the Search for Meaning.
We're talking with Steve Paulson this morning. He is the executive producer and an interviewer on WPR's show To the Best of Our Knowledge, and the author of the new collection of interviews called Adams and Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science. His interviews and his work has been featured on Salon and Slate, as well as on NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And we're looking forward to hearing from you this morning. Can science and religion coexist? Do you find the sacred in the natural world? Do you see any problem with incorporating the language of awe and wonder in science instead of strictly in the spiritual realm? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send us your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 1 o'clock today, join Ira Flato on Talk of the Nation Science Fridays. The talk turns to the life of taxidermist Carl Akeley, a guy who once killed a leopard with his bare hands. It's coming up at 1 o'clock today on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. This hour, we're joined by WPR's own Steve Paulson. He works on To the Best of Our Knowledge as executive producer and interviewer. And we're talking about finding the sacred in science, a topic which comes up time and again in his book, Adams and Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science. And we'll go to the phones right now. We have Richard joining us from Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi.
I have the answer to your question.
Okay, go ahead.
I personally do not think that they are compatible. I teach science, and even though I don't claim science has all the answers, I teach biology, and I still can't tell my students the difference between why a rock is not alive and a bird is alive. However, really, religion ends with the answer that it's magic, and I don't find that at all compatible with science. And that was my comment. I wonder if you could talk about that.
All right. Thank you, Richard.
Well, I guess the question, I mean, this raises an interesting point, because I think a lot of people would say that science is by definition value-free. Science is a methodology, and it's not going to tell you how to live. And I that's certainly true, I think. But the question is, what do you do with that information about science? Let's say you're not religious, and you don't believe there's any kind of higher being. There's no sort of innate purpose. Where do you try to find your meaning? I mean, where do you try to sort of figure out a way, sort of almost a larger sense, a worldview of how to live? And I think that's where the religious impulse comes from a lot. So, I mean, there's one way to think about religion, which is, okay, it's, you know, you're talking about God as kind of the cosmic magician in the sky who performs miracles. And a lot of people in this day and age have trouble with that. There's another more inclusive definition of religion, which is it's really a sense of ultimate purpose. And maybe there is no God. Maybe there's no underlying sort of force there. But there's this sense, you might have this overwhelming sense that, you know, I'm here for a reason. And that might be a religious impulse, even if you don't believe in God. So it a lot rides on how you think about religion, what your definition of that word is.
And Richard, I'm curious, what did you think as you listened to David Abram? Richard, are you with us?
I'm sorry. Was that free? Well, I understand those things, but to include religion solely as for ethical reasons, I think misses the point of religion, that religion without a supernatural element really isn't religion anymore. You're talking ethics now, is the way I would view that.
All right. Well, thank you for your comment, Richard. We appreciate it. And we'll move to Gary joining us from Boscobel. Hi, Gary.
Thank you. Steve, I was interested in your comment about the topic of animism.
Uh-huh.
And you mentioned the possibility of even rock having a presence or a feeling of spirit. And I'm a flint napper, and that means that I take particular types of rocks and reproduce ancient spear tips and arrowheads and knives out of them. And there's no question in within the group of people that flint nap that rock definitely has a tremendous amount of energy and a tremendous amount of power in it. And every time every time you take a flake off of a rock, it makes a large cracking sound. And once a piece is finished, if you take a dozen different blades that you've made and lay them on a surface and tap them, they make musical notes just like a xylophone. So that in itself says that there is definitely stored energy there, and there is musical energy within those rocks. So that kind of, for me, sheds a different light on a different perspective on the way I look at the world around me. Is everything is a source of energy, and everything is stored energy. And then one of the other questions you brought up was, can science and nature coexist? And I think it's more a question of, can man and nature coexist, as far as man's approach to nature and the value that he places on it. And thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Gary. What an interesting perspective. If you haven't, David Abram would get along well with Gary.
Yeah,
I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I might mention my brother is a landscape gardener, and he often works with large rocks. And he's kind of an artist the way he does this. And he'll sometimes talk about how the rocks get loose as he's, you know, sort of loading them off his truck. And I mean, there's this sense that, I mean, he sort of, literally, they're not alive, but they can sort of feel like they are.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for that. And how about an email here we have from Bill in Madison, who says, I tend to think of an experience as religious when it involves two things interacting, our everyday concrete world and that which seems beyond what our everyday world is. People of different religious groups tell their stories about these experiences differently, and that's what makes different denominations. But our opinion of what is religious seems to change with time. Interesting about he's getting at the idea that two things are interacting, sort of what's ineffable, what you can't put into words, and the material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I would also say that there are interesting kind of cultural manifestations of how people are, I think, rethinking religion now. To cite an example from literature, Margaret Atwood, the great Canadian novelist, she wrote a novel, I think it came out a year ago, called The Year of the Flood, and it's set in this kind of post-apocalyptic world. The virus has wiped out most of humanity. One of her main characters is starting a new religion. And it's a homegrown religion. So it's not, you know, it's not sort of, you know, Christianity, but it's a nature-based religion. And in fact, for this book, what Margaret Atwood did is she wrote hymns. And so she created her own hymns. And then she has a friend who is, I think, a pastor at some church and who has a musical group. And they actually put these hymns to music. And so, I mean, this is a work of fiction. But she is saying, it's not just sort of this work of the imagination. I mean, there is this movement afoot right now for people to look to nature for religious inspiration. She uses that word, religion.
Just curious, did she release the CD with the book so that you could listen and read?
Is she going to? You can get a hold of that CD. Maybe it's on the web or something like that. I heard some of the songs.
Are they any good?
I think they could have done a little better on the musical front.
Okay, well, let's go to Mark joining us from Eau Claire. Hello, Mark.
Hi. I've thought a lot about this subject, and it kind of seems to me that in the scientific community, there seems to be this big effort among those who work in theoretical physics and cosmology to conflate the idea of an omnipresent God with the idea of some sort of unified field theory. But what I find fascinating is the general progression of Christianity and the tendency of theists to interpret more of the Bible as allegory as time goes on. Christians today interpret many more Bible stories as allegory than did their parents. So my theory is that eventually Bible stories, including the Jesus story, will be thought of as an allegory for a unified field theory, maybe. And I find the idea of Jesus as a means to connect humans with God could easily be interpreted as a way of showing that humans are a piece of this unified field theory, and as a result, a part of the cumulative laws of physics, which I believe is what a lot of people mistake as being God.
Well, thank you, Mark. That was interesting. And getting at the tension there between interpreting the scriptures literally and making room to see them as allegories, which might make them more compatible with science.
And there's a, of course, a huge debate among Christian theologians and historians about how to look back on the story of Jesus. And so many people look at that literally. There are also prominent theologians who would say that if you look at some of the stories in the Bible, the miracles associated with Jesus, I mean, most famously the resurrection, that if you were actually to put a camera where that happened, that you would have seen nothing, that this was beyond the realm of science. Other people would say, other theologians would say, of course you would have seen Jesus come back. So, I mean, there are vigorous debates within Christianity about that. And there's certainly, you can be a Christian and, you know, not necessarily take all those stories as sort of literal physical miracles.
Is there a move among religious intellectuals to be more inclusive of science in their teaching of scripture?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, one of the people in my book, Adams and Eden, is a Georgetown theologian named John Haught, who is a Roman Catholic theologian. He's very well versed in science, and he actually makes the point that Darwin is a gift to theology. Because his argument is that just as science keeps changing, keeps sort of modifying its views, you know, based on the latest evidence, theology needs to keep changing too. And theology needs to respond to what science shows us about the world. And the reason why he says that Darwin is a gift of theology is he's saying, you know, that really showed that a lot of the old ideas in theology were outdated. They were wrong. I mean, sort of this idea of God as creator. And he says, you know, you have to look at the story of evolution, and that forces you to rethink some sort of basic ideas about theology. So, and that would be a case of science informing a religious outlook.
Let's move on to Jim. Jim joins us from Edgerton. Hey, Jim.
Hi. Good morning. My comments are, I don't see any a problem with science and religion being compatible. I think they are compatible. I believe God created science, and so therefore when we study things, we find God in the things you study. Now, having said that, I believe that if whether you're a believer or an unbeliever, if you're a good scientist, you can study a tree and come up with the same conclusions if you're a good scientist. Now, you might have different starting points, but your findings will be the same, I believe, if you're a good scientist, whether you're a believer or a non-believer. Anyway, those are my comments. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
That is certainly the perspective of, let's say, Francis Collins, one of the most visible scientists in the country, now the head of the National Institutes of Health. He is had a PhD in quantum physics, and then he also led the government Human Genome Project. He's also an evangelical Christian. And he would say that, I mean, he does his science sort of, and, you know, as he does his science, you know, he's not bringing religion into that, but he is very religious. I mean, a strong believer in God. And he would say that for him, his belief in God informs why he thinks things turned out the way they did on Earth.
And he's been kind of controversial because of his Christian belief. Do you have any sense about how he's perceived in the science community and whether different sides are trying to appropriate him or...
I know there are some atheists who think that he should not have been appointed head of the NIH because he's so outspoken in his religious beliefs, and I think he tries to be pretty careful about when he's in his capacity at the NIH or before with the Human Genome Project not to bring religion overtly into that. He does write, though. I mean, I think he keeps a blog, and you know, so in his personal comments, he often will bring in God into that equation, but I think in his sort of his, I guess you could call 9-to-5 job, I think he tries to keep it more science-based. Mm.
An email here. This one is from Mary, who says, I dislike the negative terms used to describe people who aren't religious, that they're non-religious. It seems like we need a label that isn't negative of another position. As we know, labels do matter. And I think aren't there some new labels afoot for people like Mary?
Yeah. Well, one of the labels that is sometimes applied to these people who I consider sort of practicing, I guess what I would call sacred science, is religious naturalism. So these are people who... if you ask them sort of point blank, do you believe in God? They would say no. But they want to maintain the religious impulse. So the naturalism part of it is that, you know, they believe in essentially a materialist view of the way life works. There is no sort of higher essence there, but religious in the sense that they would consider themselves spiritual by nature. And, you know, there is that old distinction, spiritual but not religious too, and a lot of people gravitate to that.
What about the Brights? Now remind me what the Brights are again. That's
they are some atheists like Daniel Dennett have taken on that label basically to say that it's just sort of another word for atheism. Some atheists have liked that word and others have not. So there's sort of a small collection.
Is
of
it catching on?
I don't know if it is or not.
No, it's hard. It's like giving yourself your own nickname. It might catch on, or
right.
It might not.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, I know that this turned a little bit personal for you. You said after you had read the David Abram book and his experiences with this raven and this shaman, that you tried to sort of walk that road yourself. Can you tell us just personally what happened? How was it?
A little bit. You know, it's just, I mean, when you... It's always kind of mysterious why a particular book affects you. And for whatever reason, this David Abram book kind of hit me at the right moment. And so I just, you know, it really resonated with me. And I thought a lot about it. And, you know, I just found myself when I was outside in particular, you know, just feeling all the, you know, the wind on me, or you're, you know, listening a little more intently, just being more aware. I mean, that's really what it is, being more aware of being in the world. And I'm someone who can very easily get wrapped up in my head, and to kind of let go a little bit and let kind of let my senses sort of take over, sort of experience the world more intently. And then I've had a few experiences in recent years where I've been out in, well, there was one time when I was in Hawaii, on the island Kauai, and I had this kind of overwhelming experience. I guess what I would call an ecstatic experience of just sort of feeling just sort of overwhelmed by the beauty of everything, sort of walking in the Waimea Canyon and how it just, you know, that what the mystics talk about is sort of that feeling of oneness. And it was just, I had this really overpowering feeling like that. And yeah, certainly a lot of other people have had those experiences as well. It hasn't happened very often for me, but every so often it does.
And did you feel like David Abram, did you feel as though you sensed a presence, maybe not spirit, but did you sense a presence in the world around you, the living world?
I probably wouldn't use that word. I mean, sort of the feel. I remember that sort of the feeling very powerfully to me is it's that everything felt right. That was sort of the feeling for me. But you know, whether there was sort of a living presence, I don't know. No, not necessarily.
Well, thanks for sharing.
Sure.
Before break, we have time for one more phone call here. How about Dick calling us from Waukesha? Hi, Dick.
Was that Waukesha?
Right. You're up.
Yes. I had an experience when I was in college. I worked in the library, and I discovered that at the end of the aisles there is a single desk, and that's where I went after supper to study. And I'd fall asleep after 15 minutes and snooze a little bit, and then I was good until the library closed. But one night I was sitting there reading with my head on my hand and elbow on the table, and all of a sudden I was 20 feet above me, looking down on me, on myself. And that was amazing. And I wasn't frightened. And that happened several times over the, I don't know, maybe a few days apart. And one time I wondered whether I could move. So I did. I moved up the aisle toward the, I don't know, 15 or 20 feet, and I got a little scared. I thought, geez, what if I get stuck up here? And I was able to cause it to happen. But the first time it just happened. What the heck was that?
Yeah, Steve, what was that?
Well, I mean, that is called an out-of-body experience. Right. And there's a pretty big literature
on there's
that.
A lot of people who have had experiences that they feel that they can't quantify or discuss in terms of what we know. How does science look at ideas and experiences like Dick?
That's a tough one for science to handle. There is, I might add, there is a scientist, I believe he's at the University of Virginia, Bruce Grayson, who's trying to study this. And, you know,
he's at the University of Virginia?
Mm-hmm, I believe. And so he studies near-death experiences. And one of the things, one of the stories that you often hear from people who, I don't know about often, but occasionally you hear from people who, let's say, are on the operating table, is that they will sometimes feel that they have, say, left their body and are looking down on the surgery. And he is trying, I think he's placed a camera like up at the, from the top of the room, sort of looking down. You know, the idea being that someone who's in surgery is presumably unconscious, has been knocked out and wouldn't be aware. And so how do you get these reports of people, you know, sort of be, apparently being able to observe what has been said by the surgeons or whatever? And I don't think he's found anything so far. So, but I mean, it raises an interesting question about how much are there certain parts of reality that are beyond the capacity of science to explain? So, and you don't have to talk about God here. I mean, it's just, are there certain sort of aspects of our life that might be real, but yet are beyond science? It's just, it's an open question and a pretty fascinating question.
And remind me, there's a book that I think Dick might enjoy from an NPR reporter who references that, and also mm-hmm. her own experiences sort of trying to track down some of these experiences and whether or not you can explain them with science. What is her name, Steve?
Barbara Bradley Haggerty.
Thank you. And what is her book called? Do you remember?
Fingerprints of God.
Fingerprints of God. Okay, well, maybe that would be a good reading for you, Dick, and thank you for that call. We're talking this morning with Steve Paulson, who's the author of the new collection of interviews called Adams and Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science. Steve is executive producer of Wisconsin Public Radio's nationally syndicated radio program, To the Best of Our Knowledge. And you may have heard his work on Morning Edition or All Things Considered as well. And we're looking forward to taking more of your phone calls for the rest of this hour. Can science and religion coexist? Where do you find the sacred in your daily life? Do you turn to religion? Do you find the sacred in the natural world? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you today on the Ideas Network on Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 2 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation Science Friday for a preview of next week's lunar eclipse and a look at a patient called SM, a woman who doctors say doesn't experience fear. That's 2 o'clock's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. We're in the studio this morning with Steve Paulson. You know him as an interviewer from To the Best of Our Knowledge on Wisconsin Public Radio. And he's got a new book out called Adams and Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science. And we're going to listen to another clip from one of your interviews, Steve, Stuart Kaufman.
Right. Stuart Kaufman is one of the gurus of complexity theory. He's a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award. And he wrote a book recently called Reinventing the Sacred, which is really fascinating because he's one of these secular scientists who is trying to appropriate the language of religion. And the thing that's especially provocative about what he's doing is he's actually trying to sort of change the meaning of the word God, you know, sort of taking away the traditional notion of the transcendent God. And instead, he talks about God as the ceaseless creativity in the universe, which he calls stunning, awesome, and worthy of reverence. And what he's trying to do is he doesn't like the sort of the traditional reductive approach of science, which is sort of like if you sort of break everything down to its component parts, you ultimately get to physics. And he's saying, no, there are all kinds of properties that don't work that way. I mean, there's life, there's value, there's meaning, there's consciousness. He says those things really cannot be reduced ultimately to sort of the laws of physics. And so he says we need a new language, a new way of thinking about things. And so, and I think in this clip we're going to talk about, we're going to hear, it's why he is trying to invent this new meaning for the word God.
God is the most powerful symbol humanity has created. We've been worshiping God or gods at least since the sacred Earth Mother 10,000 years ago in Europe. Whether it's the creator, transcendent God of the Abrahamic tradition or other notions of God, God carries with it a sense of awe, reverence, wonder that no other symbol carries. Now we have our choice. Is it more astonishing to believe that a creator God created everything that has come to exist, the planets, the galaxies, chemistry, life, consciousness, agency, in 6 days? Or is it equally or even more astonishing and awesome to believe what is almost certainly the truth, namely that all of this came to be all on its own?
Okay, you can say all that, but you don't have to talk about God. And yet you, for some reason, want to invoke...
I want to invoke God.
Yeah, why?
It is precisely to say that God is nature, or God is in nature. And that's the God of Spinoza. That's the God that Einstein believed in. If we can transfer our secular humanist, consumerist worldview into one in which we have this sense of responsibility, awe, and wonder for all life, we are inventing a global ethic that we don't have now, yet we need it to sustain the global civilization that's emerging.
A clip there from Stuart Kaufman talking about changing the word God. You know, it's interesting to me listening to Stuart Kaufman talk there is that I think if you referenced mystical texts throughout history, you would find people who probably believe much as Stuart Kaufman does, kind of like describing an elephant from two different angles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and there are, I mean, there are different ways of thinking about religion. One is, you know, sort of trying to understand sort of the deeper theological ideas, sort of larger religious concepts, or to talk about it as essentially as experience, religious as being experiential above all. And that was, for instance, the perspective that William James took. William James, the great philosopher and psychologist who wrote his classic book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, I think just over 100 years ago. And he was saying that, I mean, he talked about the varieties of religious experience, plural. There's not just one religious experience. There are many different ways. And so he's saying it's like it's how it's lived. That's really what the essence of religion is. And I think that's a little bit of what Stuart Kaufman is talking about.
Another phone call here. We're going to go to Mike joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. If you have an unverifiable hypothesis, such as religion, because you can't prove it or disprove it, and using Occam's razor in order to get to the simplest ideas, you have to have some way of experimentally showing that something exists. Otherwise, if it's in the realm of hypothesis and you're getting paid, then it's, you know, that's one thing. But if you're just making up ideas and putting them out there to try and explain everything, that's another thing. It's called science fiction. So my question is religion science fiction because you can't verify it? It's simply a hypothesis that you can neither prove nor disprove.
But I think there would be a lot of people who would call themselves religious who would say they don't need to try to verify it. It's something they feel. And maybe an outsider would call it science fiction, but they would say, well, it feels very real to me. So, I mean, there are different levels of how you can talk about this. There's sort of at the lived experiential level. And then there's if you try to talk about the underlying sort of metaphysics of it all, what is real there. And that's where you get some of the conflicts between science and religion. And then there are the questions of epistemology, which is, what can we actually understand? I mean, what can, through the lens of science, for instance, what can we know about the world? And it's an open question whether science, how much science can explain about the world we live in.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And we move to Joan, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I'm very lucky, I think. I'm a Roman Catholic, but I go to a Native American church. And I took my grandson, who is part Native American, to see the frog exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum. These are live. They look like art, but they're alive. And if you haven't seen it, you should. It is awe-inspiring. And I think there is no conflict. We can't let there be a conflict between science and religion. We have to respect what we have here, and the greatest respect is probably to live it, experience it, study it, but enjoy it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that call, Joan, and for telling us about the exhibit of frogs as well. I'm wondering, as science tries to, I don't want to say appropriate, incorporate more of the language of the spiritual, of awe and wonder, do you see that as doing, in effect, making the gap between science and religion shorter, or is this going to widen it? Is it going to help someone like Joan relate more to scientists and vice versa if they're using the same language?
I think it will help them. And again, it so much depends on what you mean by these, particularly by the word religion, and what you mean by the word God. I mean, what you think God is, just a lot. I mean, sort of your worldview will sort of shape those definitions. But I think there's an open question right now about whether in the future, in the coming decades, there might be more religious movements that are kind of nature-based, maybe moving away from some of the old sort of, let's say, Abrahamic religions, you know, sort of the God-centered religions. And there is, for instance, if I can cite another book, there's a new book by a professor of religious studies named Bron Taylor called Dark Green Religion. Hmm. And he is talking, what he sees is there's a growing number of people who, again, wouldn't consider themselves religious in the classical sense, but have such a love of nature that they are sort of finding religion there. And he is predicting that in the, you know, assuming humanity is still here in the coming centuries, that some of the traditional ideas of religion will fall away because they just don't seem to sort of hold up in the light of science, and instead we'll have new sort of nature-based religions. Hmm. And, you know, it's an open question whether that would happen. And if I can just add one other thing, the reason why he says dark green religion is he says there's often sometimes sort of a dangerous component to this because there is a radical element to this. You know, if you think back to Edward Abbey, the great nature writer who, you know, advocated the sort of sabotaging the developing, a cutting down of trees and all of that. And, you know, there is sometimes an anarchist and even sort of violent fringe to that way of thinking. So it's just sort of, it's, if you really take these, if sort of preserving nature is your bottom line belief, it almost becomes sort of a religious impulse in itself.
Well, it's interesting that people would be, I guess, creating new religions when there has been movements in the past for people to go back to Native American spiritual traditions or even, you know, Wiccan, pagan spiritual mm-hmm. traditions. So you're talking about the creation of new religions.
Possibly. Sure. Yeah. I mean, who's to say that, you know, all religions were created 2,000 years ago or 1,500 years or 3,000 years ago? I mean, you know, maybe there could be new religions. Hmm. Yeah.
And as long as we're getting close to the top of the hour here, we mentioned you'd give us a little bit of a reading list. Now, we've mentioned a couple already. We have David Abram, Becoming Animal. We have the Barbara Bradley Haggerty mm-hmm. and her book,
Fingerprints of God.
Fingerprints of God. Mm-hmm. Give us one or two more.
Another one of the classic books in this genre is by Ursula Goodenough, who's a cell biologist at Washington University. And she wrote a book called The Sacred Depths of Nature. And again, a secular scientist who is looking for sort of the awe and wonder in nature. In physics, I mentioned earlier that really this movement cuts across scientific disciplines. There's a cosmologist at UC Santa Cruz named Joel Primack, who is the co-author of a book called The View from the Center of the Universe. Hmm. And he is making the argument that, again, secular scientist, doesn't believe in God, but he's trying to sort of get away from the idea that we're just sort of this cosmic accident, where it's just this insignificant speck in the universe. And he's saying that, you know, if you actually understand science, our size is sort of roughly between sort of the biggest things in the universe, the galaxies, and the smallest things, subatomic particles. And he sort of goes through various ways that, you know, why humans are special. Jane Goodall is another one of the most prominent people in this whole area, sort of the great chimpanzee researcher, and she's written various memoirs going back to the 60s of her time there, and she definitely has a kind of a spiritual sort of edge to her. And I'll just mention one last book. There's a psychiatrist at Harvard named George Valiant who wrote a book called Spiritual Evolution, A Scientific Defense of Faith. And he's looking at different parts of the brain and what sparks religious feelings.
Is this an exciting time in the world of science? The way you talk about it, it sounds as though you're describing almost like the cusp of a revolution here about science doing its best to fill the role that religion has filled. And I don't know how religion necessarily is responding, but is this an unusual time that we're living in?
I think it is. And I mean, this I'm just talking about a little sort of sliver of the scientific community here. I mean, there are a lot of scientists who would think this is nonsense, what we're talking about. But for people who really have, I guess, what you would call the religious impulse, but for whatever reason can't buy into traditional religious ideas, you know, where do you look for some sense of meaning? And they are looking to science. They are looking to nature for that. And I think, yeah, I think it is a very exciting time.
Looking into your crystal ball for a moment, where do you see this front line of religion and science? How do you see it playing out in the next, I don't know, 50 years?
Oh, my goodness. my crystal ball gets
pretty... In 10 seconds or less. No,
it gets pretty cloudy. I think we'll see more books like this. And mm-hmm. I think we'll hear more people talking about these kinds of things. And I think there will be, especially as nature becomes more endangered, people will recognize the value of it and perhaps will read religious meanings into it.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us. It was great to have you here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Steve Paulson with us this morning, the author of the new collection, Adams in Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science. Steve is executive producer of WPR's nationally syndicated program, To the Best of Our Knowledge. And you probably heard him on Morning Edition and All Things Considered as well. Well, if you'd like to see a picture of Steve here in the studio, you can do so on our Facebook page, WPR.org. You'll find a link there by clicking on Veronica Rickert. Hope you have a good listening day today, and I'll be back with you next hour as well. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.